the reservoir. The village of Pennell is just half a mile downstream. BBC News.
Now the concluding part of our classic serial.
We present Nancy Carroll in Publish and Be Damned, the memoirs of Harriet Wilson, written by herself and dramatised by Ellen Dryden. Episode 2. I hate to dwell long on any subject unless indeed it were the merits of these my most interesting and valuable memoirs, which, I assure you, might have been better still, but that Stockdale won't let me or anyone else study and correct them. The merits of such a light work as this, stupidly, says he, is that it is written without study, and just as you converse. There are learned books enough, but write in your own natural language, and of life, manners, and men as they strike you, and take my word for it, the book will sell. So here I am, seated on an easy chair in the Rue du Faubourg Saint-Honoré à Paris, writing not for the benefit of my readers, but for my own amusement and profit, in the full expectation that my work is to pass the 20th edition. If I have the knack to amuse the public, I shall expect the public to be extremely grateful to me and sing my praises to the end of their natural life. Lord Ponsonby and myself met every evening for more than a week. He generally came to me as soon as it was dark, nor did we always wait for the evening to see each other, though respect for Lady Ponsonby made us avoid all risk of wounding her feelings.
How very odd. I do believe you like Fanny.
I like her as much as I should dislike any woman who did not love you dearly. Listen to me, Ponsonby. All my religion is from my heart, and not from books. If ever our intimacy is discovered, we must separate forever. We are not monsters. We will never indulge in selfish enjoyment at the expense of misery to any one of our fellow creatures, much less one who depends on you for all her happiness.
And she is very happy, thank God. And I would rather forfeit my life than destroy her peace.
One night, about a week from the day Ponsonby first visited me, when I did not expect him till midnight, I retired to bed and fell fast asleep. When I awoke, the sun was shining through my curtains. My first thoughts were always on Ponsonby, and I recollected with a deep feeling of disappointment that he had promised the night before to come to me by midnight. I felt for his little watch, which I always placed under my pillow. Judge my astonishment to find, attached to it, a magnificent gold chain of exquisite workmanship. I began to think myself in the land of fairies, and still more so when I observed a very beautiful pearl ring on one of my fingers. A very small strip of writing paper, which I had drawn from under my pillow with my watch, now caught my attention, and I read, written with a pencil in Ponsonby's small, beautiful character.
Sleep, dear child. I love you too tenderly to wake you.
It was very sentimental and affectionate, for Ponsonby knew how much I required rest. Dear Ponsonby, you are the first man on earth who ever sacrificed his own pleasure and passions to secure my repose. To such of the kind public as may have a perverted taste for the serious, I beg leave to state that I am now making my debut in a tragic part. I hope that my tragical adventures will furnish more interest to my readers than they supplied amusement to me. Lord Ponsonby's attachment to me continued for nearly 3 years. Towards the end of that period, he appeared unusually melancholy one evening.
Are you out of health or out of spirits? I'm sure that your hands are feverish.
But now you've discovered it, I'm going to die. Would you miss me? I will not ask you, for I'm sure you would.
He now took up some paper and began to write, holding his hand before the paper to prevent my seeing a single line.
What are you writing?
Private business.
It struck me that it must be something for me, or that he would not have written it at my house. Lord Ponsonby had often hinted that he wished to make a provision for me during my life of £200 a year. I imagined that this might be something of a promise to that effect, but I knew him at that time to be very poor and much in debt.
I must go. Who would have imagined that it could be so late?
Must you go home already?
Not home, but to the House of Lords. But, my dear Harriet, I cannot lose you at this moment. Will you come down with me in a hackney coach as far as the house?
With all my heart, my love.
I beg you to allow me to wait for you. I do not care if it should be all night, for you'll come at last and we can drive towards your house together.
You're very good, but the house will sit late and I cannot bear the idea of you waiting.
My dearest Ponsonby, I am very happy in waiting for you. He did not again return to me for more than 3 hours. It was daylight. He seemed to be dreadfully unwell and fatigued. I had never seen him thus since the death of his father. He gave me, I think, almost 100 kisses without uttering a single word.
You are much fatigued, dear Ponsonby. I only wish to heaven I might stay with you and take care of you forever.
I have a letter for you.
You must excuse my taking it, because I will tell you frankly, I rather guess it is to secure me the provision which you have so often talked about. I am no liar, Ponsonby. I most solemnly declare to you that I will never accept any annuity from you, unless you were to become so rich as to make one without the slightest inconvenience to yourself or your family.
I then tore the letter into many pieces and threw it out of the coach window.
My dear Harriet, it is indeed, as you say, very hard upon us that we may not pass the whole of our lives together. But then be assured, happen what will, of my affection for you, to whom I owe some of the happiest hours I have ever known.
The kiss which followed this declaration was as long and as ardent as our first. Yet alas, how different that parting kiss. On the following evening, while I was expecting Ponsonby, I received a letter from him to inform me that we had parted forever. I remember little of the letter. Something about a discovery made by Lady Ponsonby and a solemn promise extorted from him to see me only once more, when he intended to have explained and arranged everything but could not.
No! Dreadful! This is nonsense! Refuse to speak to me. Look on me as a stranger he could not. It would be too cruel even to one's greatest enemy. And his nature is so kind. Gracious God, how can he have left me? How many times have I stood by this window watching him approach? Oh, it is not high enough and would only half destroy me. I will go to him first. But no, no, no. I will not risk her happiness. I am not really wicked. Not so very wicked as to deserve this dreadful calamity. Gracious God, if I am to see Ponsonby no more, in your divine mercy, take me out of a world of such bitter suffering before the morning. Death, and only death, can relieve me. But then what is death? Ponsonby's neglect, Ponsonby's late passion, his smile, and his last long kiss cannot torture me after this little palpitation has ceased. Yet I will suffer first and suffer long that I may pray for your forgiveness. Only let it be my consolation that this will terminate all. Alas, I am going out of the world very young and very miserably. He would have returned to me. He loves me. And while there is life, there is hope.
I've never seen him from that hour. My housekeeper was so alarmed that after putting me to bed, sent for Dr. Bain, who assured me that I was in a high fever. He and my sister Fanny said and did everything the most tender friendship could dictate. To be brief, their kind attention and my own excellent constitution triumphed over the fever which had been severe during 5 days. In a little more than a fortnight, I left my bed, though reduced to a mere shadow of what I had been. The next morning I was surprised by a visit from the Duke of Wellington, who had unexpectedly arrived from the continent the night before.
How do you do? What have you been about?
Fixing his eyes on my pale, thin, careworn face, he absolutely started, as though he had seen the ghost of some man he had killed. Honestly, of course.
What the devil is the matter?
Something has affected me deeply, and I have been ill for more than 2 months.
Poor girl. I always dreaded your getting into some scrape. Do you recollect I told you so? How much money do you want?
I have no money. Not a single shilling, but this is not the cause of my sufferings.
Nonsense.
Said the man of sentiment, drawing near the table and taking up my pen to write a draft.
Where the devil is Argyle? Why do you not make him pay your debts? I will give you what I can afford now, and you must write to me, as usual, at Thomas's Hotel, if this is not sufficient. Good God, how thin you are grown. Were you sorry I left you? I remember you shed tears when I told you I was off for Spain. I am a cold sort of fellow. I dare say you think so. And yet I have not forgotten that either. Because there is no humbug about you. And when you cry, you are sorry, I believe. I have thought of you very often in Spain. Particularly one night, I remember, I dreamt you came out on my staff.
Wellington consoled me as well as he could, and sat with me nearly shocked to see me so ill. About this time, the Duke of Argyle arrived from Scotland. He was greatly shocked to see me so ill.
I've just dined with Ponsonby, and I never saw him look better. He showed me a letter containing an invitation from that nasty sister of yours, Amy, who wanted to have me last year. I have had a narrow escape.
From what?
A rape.
Who in this land of plenty is so very hard up?
Your sister, Amy. She asked me to see her to a coach, then insisted on setting me down, drove me to her house, and would make me walk upstairs and sup with her. I was as obstinate as a stoic. Why? Where are you going? To a sick relation of yours, was my answer. She looked like a fury as she wished me good night.
How you abuse her. Really, you seem to have entirely forgotten our relationship.
Well, she sets me the example.
I fought Amy's battles as long and as earnestly as though she had really loved me, assuring him that she was not bold and had been kind to very few lovers. At that period, I believe Argyle could have attached himself to me very sincerely, more so than formerly. His old friend, Lady W., was in a very bad state of health and was not expected to live. Argyle lamented the prospect of her loss with real friendship, and would have found consolation in my society, but for my late, desperate passion for another. Passing by Amy's door on my road home early one evening, I observed a carriage waiting. It was the Duke of Argyle's. I could not possibly be in love with Argyle. I had given too many absurd proofs of love for another for that. And yet I had never ceased to admire and like him. My nerves had undergone a shock, which to this day I have not recovered. Most probably I shall never enjoy another hour's health. At that time, a mere nothing affected me. One fine morning, Amy, having heard the occasion of it and sporting fine feelings, came suddenly into my room.
Oh, Harriet! My poor dear sister! Such a death-like aspect! Oh, poor dearest Harriet!
You disgusting, hypocritical, deceitful creature. You intrude into my house, warm from the embraces of my lover, pregnant, to show off your
tenderness for me, ha! In full, warm, sisterly confidence, I introduced you to the Duke. I praised you till I changed his disgust into something like partiality. I dressed you up in my own elegant clothes because yours are always as shabby as they are showy, like your black pudding dinners and champagne suppers. It is painful to my heart to acknowledge a sister so unnatural. Since you have forced your company on me, you shall repent it. I then looked round for some instrument to execute vengeance. Readers, can you conceive anything half so monstrous? I was thinking about killing her.
Help! Help! Sir, boy! Boy! A wicked woman who is no better than she should be has locked me in!
I shouldn't wonder there's a pair of you no better than you should be in there.
Go out of my house, for God's sake. You are very welcome to live with Argyle if you can endure the idea. I certainly feel the loss of a friend in my present low nervous state, but His Grace knows well that I have been in love with another for the last 3 years, one on whom your effusions made not the slightest impression, except of disgust.
Amy's visit, I afterwards found, was in consequence of the anxiety Argyle had expressed concerning my health, and Amy guessed that she must show off sisterly affection or he would dislike her. The next day Argyle visited me. He was very melancholy and had scarcely shaved since Lady W.'s death, which had lately taken place.
When I loved you so dearly, you never embarrassed me or yourself. I am so unhappy now, I could devote myself entirely to you. But I see no hopes.
Yes, but a sister. The idea is so disgusting, let us not dwell on it. I forgive anything in your conduct which has caused me pain and destroyed the possibility of our ever being more than friends for the rest of our lives. And yet I trust we shall never be less. Here must end all sentiment between us. Nevertheless, whatever the cause may be, I am truly sorry to see you so changed and so melancholy.
Thank you. Then oblige me and don't tell anybody in the world that I am unhappy.
His Grace seemed to leave me with regret. I did not invite him to repeat his visit. What next, pray? The reader asks. That is to say, if I ever should be honoured with a reader, which is not at all certain. I am ready prepared and armed for abuse of every sort and kind. But not to be read. No matter. If this happens, it will be entirely Stockdale's fault for not enlivening the work with pretty pictures, as I have suggested to him, and certainly not, by the most remote possibility, be owing to any demerit of mine. Above all, I wanted Wellington to be exhibited, dripping with wet, standing opposite my street door at midnight, bawling up at Argyle, who was representing my old maidservant from my bedroom window. Oh, good gracious! I quite forgot to tell this tale. How could I be so ridiculous and negligent? Never mind, you shall have it now. It happened on the very night of Wellington's arrival from Spain, where he was said to have won a mighty battle and was hourly expected. Cannons were fired and much tallow consumed in illumination. His Grace of Argyle came to me earlier than usual on that memorable evening and found me in my bedchamber.
I swore that this night at least I will be a match for the mighty Wellington.
Surely. You must have forgotten the amiable Duchess, his bride, and all the fatigue His Grace encountered. Enough to damp the ardour of any mighty hero for one evening at any rate. Therefore, trust me, Wellington will not disturb us tonight.
Vive l'amour! Vive la guerre! Voila!
Hastily throwing my dressing gown over his shoulders and putting on one of my old nightcaps, he put his head out of my bedroom window, which was on the second floor, and soon recognised the noble chieftain Wellington.
Who is that at the door, pray?
Come down, I say, and don't keep me here in the rain, you old blockhead.
Oh, sir, you must please to call your name or I don't dare to come down. Robberies are so frequent in London just at this season and all the soldiers I see coming home from Spain that it's quite alarming to poor lone women.
Wellington took off his hat and held up towards the lamp a visage, which late fatigue and present vexation had rendered no bad representation of that of the knight of the woeful countenance Don Quixote himself, while the rain was
trickling down his nose. His voice was trembling with rage and impatience.
You old idiot! Do you know me now?
Lord, sir, I can't give no guess. And you know, sir, the thieves have stolen a new water bat out of our aerie not a week since. And my missus is more timbersome than ever.
The devil.
And muttering bitter imprecations between his closed teeth against all the duennas and old women that ever existed, returned home to his neglected wife and family duties. That's all. A few days later, I found the Duke of Leinster in my box at the opera.
I am glad you have no men with you, for I want to speak to you. A friend of mine has come up from Oxford on purpose to try to be introduced to you. He must return to college tonight, and I am rather anxious lest he should be disappointed.
Nonsense. Who is it, pray?
The Marquis of Worcester.
Is he handsome?
Not a bit of it.
What is he like?
I do not know, unless it be his father. He is a long, thin, pale fellow with straight hair.
You need not be alarmed. I shall not be presented to your friend if I can help it. I always tell everybody I know not to bring men here without first coming up to ask my permission.
I know you do. That's the answer Lord Worcester has received from several of your friends to whom he has applied. Oh, there he is. Do you observe a very tall young fellow in silk stockings looking steadfastly up at this box? Upon my honour, he won't wear trousers or curl his hair because he has heard you dislike it.
That is very flattering. Well, let me see. I looked out for him with my opera glass. The young Marquis was too bashful to withstand my gaze and turned away. But not till I had satisfied myself that he would not do for me. And in the next 5 minutes I had forgotten his existence. Late in the evening, Leinster re-entered my box accompanied by a tall young man.
I do not often introduce gentlemen to ladies, and perhaps I am taking a liberty now. Yet I hope you can have no objection to my making you known to the Marquis of Worcester.
I bowed rather formally, because I had before desired him not to bring people to me without my permission.
What do you think of him?
I will tell you tomorrow. The better to enable myself to do this, I examined the person of the young Marquis for the second time. He promised to be very good, and his air and manners were distinguished, but he was extremely pale and rather thin. Nevertheless, there was something fine and good about his countenance, though he was certainly not handsome. Leinster stroked my hair.
There is a pretty racehorse little head for you.
I never saw such beautiful hair.
Put your fingers into it. Harriet does not mind how you tumble her hair about.
I should richly deserve to be turned out of the box were I to do anything so very impertinent.
Oh, no. Anybody may pull my hair about. I like it, and I am no prude. Worcester ventured to touch my hair in fear and trembling, and the touch seemed to affect him like electricity. Without vanity, and in very truth, let him deny it if he can, I never saw a boy or a man more madly, wildly, and romantically in love with any daughter of Eve in my whole life. Leinster took his leave and went to Amy's box, leaving us alone.
May I, on my return to town, venture to pay my respects?
Certainly, if I'm in town. But we are going to Brighton.
And I return to Oxford tonight. I must start at 6 in the morning.
You must take a few hours' rest first.
That will be quite impossible.
Perhaps, Lord Worcester, it may be vain and silly in me to believe that you are disposed to like me.
Oh.
But as I wish you a good night, I assure you that I shall remember with gratitude those who are charitable enough to think favourably of me. Worcester began to look too happy. But do not mistake me, for I am not one bit in love with you. Worcester looked humble again. In fact, my love days are over. I have loved nothing lately.
Not the Duke of Leinster?
No, indeed. Worcester's countenance brightened till he became almost handsome.
If Leinster were not my friend, I would walk over his dead body before I allowed him to take you away from this place.
Oh, this love. This love. The favourite topic in town
was the Marquis of Anglesey's elopement with the wife of Sir Henry Wellesley. His Grace of Argyll was soon expected to console Lady Anglesey by the offer of his hand and heart, if that good lady could contrive, by hook or by crook, by English law or by Scotch law, to obtain her liberty. Amy, my tartar of a sister, believed that she was to become the legitimate wife of the Duke of Argyll. At last, when she was very near her confinement, Argyll, fearful lest the sad truth might fall heavier on her tender heart from the third person than from his own lips, one fine morning after breakfast, having no doubt previously fortified himself with a bumper of brandy, told her with the utmost delicacy the appalling fact that he was about to marry Lady Anglesey. Amy had a hysterical fit, and vented her rage in all the refined expressions usual on these occasions. At last, when a whole month had elapsed beyond the period Amy had named for that expected event, Argyll could keep on the mask no longer. The nurse had been in the house for the last month. By the time the knocker was tied up and the straw laid down and Dr. Merriman shown upstairs into her room, Amy declared herself quite well again, and so she continued for another week. I cannot help pitying anything in labour, even a mountain. At length, Amy herself really experienced the so often anticipated pains.
There can be no harm in sending to Dr. Merriman, my love.
I cannot and I will not stand it! Give me a pair of scissors! I will cut my own throat directly!
My dear lady, I should be happy to oblige you if you could first ensure my own neck.
And then, turning to the nurse as he warmed his hands by the fire...
I always let them holler and make just as much noise as they like. But for myself, as it will be necessary for me to pass the night here, I shall thank you to give me some warm blankets on that sofa with a cup of tea and a bottle of wine.
In due season, the gentle Amy was delivered of a fine boy and was duly announced to be as well as could be expected. Enough of Amy. I hate to dwell too long on any subject. It is impossible to do justice to all the delicate attentions I received from Lord Worcester during nearly 3 years. They never relaxed, but continued to the hour of our parting exactly as they had begun. My time passed on pleasantly enough at this period as I went wherever I pleased. The only drawback to my comfort was that the Duke of Beaufort did nothing but write and torment Lord Worcester to leave me. Her Grace of Beaufort's letters to her son, which I always had the honour of perusing, were extremely eloquent on the subject. The Duchess was fond of hard words. "This absurd attachment of yours for this vile woman does but prove," wrote this noble personage, "the total subjugation of your understanding." Her Grace, in her infinite condescension, then goes on to state that the Sid Harriet Wilson is the lowest and most profligate creature alive. Of course, Worcester, your own sense, she forgot that it was subjugated, will teach you to conceal this letter from the person of whom I have spoken so freely. She often declared that she should prefer seeing her son dead under his horse's feet to his ever becoming my husband. His Grace thought that we had been privately married.
It is very hard upon me. I have constantly refused to accept expensive gifts from you, and I have saved you from gambling and various other vices and misfortunes to which you would otherwise have been, shall I say, in humble imitation of Her Grace, subjugated. I have refused to become Marchioness of Worcester over and over again, and in return, your Duchess Mother, with the usual charity of all ladies who either are or pass for being chaste, insists on my being at once turned adrift into the streets and entirely unprovided for.
My father has sent me a very severe letter. He is insistent that I travel immediately to Badminton, whither they are bound. I will not go.
You should not disobey His Grace. Do not irritate your father. On the contrary, strive to set his mind at rest by assuring him that I wish you too well to marry you. True, the Duchess is very abusive. Rather vulgarly so, all things considered. But I do not deserve harsh language from your mother.
I love my father and my mother, and it would go to my heart to disobey them if I saw them inclined to act with justice and humanity towards you. At the same time, I solemnly declare to you, if it were necessary to make a choice, and I must lose forever either you or my whole family, I would not hesitate one instant. Not even if they cut me off with a shilling.
Oh.
I should prefer 10,000 times over living with you in a garret to any magnificence that could be offered me without you.
Now, what am I next to amuse my readers with? No, that's vanity. I meant to ask, what should I try to amuse them with? Worcester has gone to his papa's at Badminton, and I, being sworn to constancy, have no other beaus to write about. Let us inquire what my sister Fanny is doing. She looked very serious when I called upon her, as she sat nursing Parker's pretty little daughter and kissing it.
Colonel Parker is going to Spain.
Well, so must half the fine young men in England.
Parker is the only man on earth who has ever treated me with true respect and kindness. And my attachment to him is very strong. More so, perhaps, than you think.
No one can doubt your love for the father of your infant.
I am not romantic. It is not in my nature to be in the least romantic or sentimental. Yet when Parker forsakes me, I shall die of it.
Fiddlestick! I never saw you look better in my life. Come to me, I beg you, as soon as Parker has left. I promise I will do everything in my power to enliven you.
Do you know, I, who used to abhor solitude even for a single morning, am now become very fond of it. I love to think and to read, and the more serious the work, the better it suits. I have been copying the passages which have most struck me, and when you look them over, you will be astonished at my change of sentiments and tastes.
Have your studies been religious?
No. But the books I like now are those most calculated to teach us to endure the ills, miseries, and disappointments of this life. I shall yet, I know, suffer much in mind as well as in body, and the end of it all will be death.
We shall all die, but the time and the manner of our deaths is unknown to us. No doubt, too, we all have our portion of sorrow and trouble to look forward to. But those sorrows are seldom without some mixture of happiness. Neither of the comforts we are permitted to enjoy on earth confined to those of youthful age alone. In advanced life, we enjoy, while girls and boys pursue shadows and live on hope.
For myself, I am not, I confess, sanguine.
I interrupted her, and insisted on taking her to Julia's, where I left her, promising to see her early on the following day.
Worcester sent me about 6 sheets of foolscap scribbled all over in every corner once a day. He had, he said, been accused by the Duke, his father, of wishing to make me his wife, and he had found it impossible to deny that such was, in fact, his first hope. His father used very harsh words, and Worcester's courage had consequently increased. Suddenly, the Duke had changed his high tone and, taking his son by the hand, addressed him with much apparent feeling.
My dear, dear boy, you must forgive me if the extreme anxiety you have for such a long time occasioned myself and your poor mother has made me lose my temper. I see that your feeling for Harriet is real. Indeed, if she is good to you, I desire that every care and attention should be paid her. And you should return to her, and be teased no more on the subject. Only pass your word and honour to me, as a son and as a gentleman, that you will never marry her, and you shall hear no more from either of us on the subject.
Worcester, in his letter to me where he described this scene, professed to have been deeply affected by it, and to have passed the following night and day in tears. Yet he firmly refused to comply with his father's request. Worcester concluded his letter by declaring that I was all the consolation which was left him on earth. Since his father was about to turn his back on him forever, I answered this letter immediately. If, my dear Worcester, you do not immediately write to give me your word of honour that you have set your father's mind at rest by having complied with his late reasonable request, you will lose me now and for ever. For I shall go where you will not find me. What happiness could we enjoy at the expense of making your parents miserable?
They have good reason for what they request. I declare to you that I never will be your wife. What is there in a ceremony, and what do I care for a title? In 3 days after I had dispatched the above letter, Worcester returned to me, having made the Duke of Beaufort the promise he had required. We now enjoyed something like quietness during the remainder of our stay in London. Things went on worse and worse at Badminton, and I am now delighted that they did so, being altogether most miserably tired of the Beaufort story. I consulted a most respectable counsellor, Henry Broom, Esquire, of Old Square, Lincoln's Inn. His Grace, the Duke of Beaufort, has sent a notorious swindler of his acquaintance to me, one Mr. Robinson, who has long been in the habit of doing dirtier jobs for noblemen, and has been confined in chains for forgery. He was sent to inform me that I had it in my power to relieve the anxiety and distress of the Duke and Duchess of Beaufort by returning all the letters in my possession containing promises of marriage made by the Marquis of Worcester, with the condition that I never speak or write to his lordship again.
I conceive the letters, if brought into a court of law, to be worth a considerable sum to you, Miss Wilson.
May I inquire if my situation, previous to my having been under the protection of Lord Worcester, makes any difference?
The court would not discuss that point, nor take it into the smallest consideration for or against you. You have, for anything which can be proved to the contrary, in all probability, been prevented from establishing yourself eligibly or comfortably in life by having received the most solemn promises of marriage from the Marquis of Worcester. The Duke has no witness of your having ever refused the Marquis. On the contrary, you tell me His Grace will not believe a single syllable of the matter. Lord Worcester has, by the date of these letters, been pledging his faith to you for the space of 2 years, and I conceive the damages, if he should now declare off, would be rated at least at £20,000.
The next day I had a second interview with Mr. Robinson, to whom I repeated the opinion of Mr. Broom and promised him that His Grace would receive my decided answer by the next day's post. He claimed that this would not be regular, and it had better pass through his hands. I declared that I must and will manage matters in my own way. Mr. Robinson was at length compelled to leave me, although in a very ill humour. One morning, some weeks later, I received a letter from Worcester, so blotted over from one end to the other and effaced with tears that it was scarcely legible. All I could make out of this scrawl as certain was that Wellington, at the request of Worcester's father, who had made it without his son's knowledge, had appointed him his aide-de-camp, and that go he must, or it would be called cowardice if he hesitated. I burst into a violent flood of tears. That he would lose his life in Spain, I felt convinced, and that because his regiment remained in England, I should have his blood on my head. What was to be done? My crimson velvet pelisse, trimmed with white fur, and also my white beaver hat, with a charming plume of feathers, were spread out in my dressing room, ready for Hyde Park and conquests. And poor Worcester perhaps might soon be numbered with the dead, food for worms. After a second flood of tears, on went the red pelisse and charming white hat, and in half an hour, behold me standing at the Duke of Beaufort's street door with a little note in my hand containing these few words addressed to the Duke. I earnestly entreat Your Grace to permit me to speak a few words to you before you attend the levee this morning. Your most obedient, humble servant, Harriet Wilson. When His Grace's huge, fat porter opened the door, I made a desperate effort to conceal my tears, which had been flowing in abundance ever since I had read poor Worcester's letter, and I delivered my little note, requesting to be allowed to wait for the Duke's answer. The porter looked on me suspiciously. He seemed to be considering His Grace of Beaufort's moral character, as his eye glanced from my face downward.
Are you quite certain that it is the Duke himself you want to see, and not the young Marquis?
I wish very much either to see the Duke, or to receive an answer to my note.
His Grace shall have the note directly. The Duke is dressing for the levee, so you had better take a seat.
I did so. While I was almost choked with the efforts to conceal my tears from the parcel of curious, impudent servants, who for nearly 20 minutes that I was suffered to remain in the hall were eyeing me with a very impertinent curiosity. I waited another quarter of an hour in a very miserable state of suspense and in real bodily fear of being kicked out of the house. At last, as I sat with my handkerchief to my eyes and my face turned towards the ground, I heard someone, in a mild, gentleman-like voice, call from the bottom of the stairs to inquire if the person was waiting who had brought the last note. I raised my head, and seeing a handsome-looking man in court dress, who appeared to be a very little older than Worcester, I grew brave, as I always do from desperation, conceiving everything was now lost, and that the Duke had descended himself to issue orders for my being kicked into the street.
Did you bring this note, pray?
I did, Your Grace.
Then do me the favour to walk this way. My bell was broken, and for the last 10 minutes before I came down, I could not make anyone hear. But I assure you, I had no idea you yourself were waiting in my hall. I conceived it was your messenger.
The least sound of kindness to one already so very low and nervous is enough to affect one. The tears I had made such efforts to conceal from the servants would be restrained no longer.
I am not aware of your motive, Miss Wilson, for favouring me with the visit. Sit down. I beg you will sit down and compose yourself. And don't think it necessary to speak until you are calm. I hope you believe I feel very much shocked that you should have waited in my hall. Upon my honour, I had no conception of finding you there when I went downstairs.
Your Grace, on the receipt of Lord Worcester's letter, I felt so very shocked at the idea of being the sole cause of him being sent into danger while his regiment remains quietly in England, that I found it impossible to resist making an effort to prevent it. I propose to do all in my power to induce his lordship to consent to our separation. If I fail, I will go abroad myself and keep my residence a secret from him so that he will not be exposed to danger because of me.
Even had I been inclined to comply with your request, and I honestly confessed, I am not. It is now too late. And really, Miss Wilson, it was from the first folly and madness in you ever to have fancied Worcester could or would have made you his wife.
Your Grace still believes me desirous of the honour I might obtain by forcing myself on you as your despised relative. And pray, do you imagine that if I wished and would consent to marry your son, I should fail to accomplish my designs?
Certainly.
Duke, you neither deceive me nor yourself by that assertion, for you know the contrary. I am naturally good, but you will, among you, harden my heart till it becomes cold and vicious. Since nothing generous, no sacrifice on my part, is understood or felt, even when I only think of others, you will not, or you cannot, understand me. Allow me then to tell you that the fault is in your own character. I will not say in your heart, but in your want of heart.
I did not mean to hurt your feelings, I assure you. Perhaps I expressed myself improperly. I only wanted to observe to you that such unequal marriages are seldom, if ever, attended with happiness to either party. As witness Lord Egremont, and several more I could name.
Do not trouble yourself, Duke, since I am, and I always was, determined not to marry your son. If you again speak to me as though you entirely disbelieved this positive assurance which has been repeated so often to your son, while on his knees he implored me to become his wife, I shall say you do so because I am a woman and cannot call you to account for it. Your Grace would use more ceremony with a man. But my object for the great presumption of thus intruding on you was the hope of being able to suggest some plan
which would render it unnecessary for Lord Worcester to join the Duke of Wellington's staff. You have answered me on that subject, and I have now the honour to take my leave of your grace.
Not yet. Pray, stay till you are more tranquil. Shall I get you a glass of water?
Thank you, that is unnecessary. He insisted on my waiting while he himself went into his dressing room to procure one.
Now, I hope you are quite convinced that your being left in my hall was contrary to my knowledge, and gives me real concern.
I have spoken to Lord Worcester's father for the first and, in all probability, the last time in my life.
And if it should happen so?
Will your grace shake hands with me?
With great pleasure.
After shaking hands, rather cordially, he himself conducted me into the hall and summoned the porter to attend and open the door for me. To proceed with my disasters, the next was a pressing letter from Stockdale declaring that he must have the rest of my memoirs because folks began to think it was all a hoax. Arrived at Mr. Stockdale's house, I handed him over the chief part of my delectable memoirs. I conceived that my disasters were now completely at an end, and I looked forward to a rich harvest with unbounded applause. Unfortunately, Stockdale, in a courteous fit, acquainted the immortal Wellington that I was about to publish part of his private life. His Grace has written to menace a prosecution if such trash be published. What trash, my dear Wellington? Now, I will admit, and it really is very good of me, that you are an excellent judge of literature. Still, in order to pronounce it trash, we should fancy that even Wellington himself must throw a hasty glance on one of its pages at least. Quite the contrary. Wellington knows himself to be the subject, and therefore wisely prejudges the book trash one fortnight before it sees the light. My own Wellington, who has sighed over me and groaned over me by the hour, talked of my wonderful beauty, bribed Mrs. Porter over and over again for a single smile from his beautiful Harriet. And was not I the object of his first most ardent wishes on his arrival from Spain? Only it was such a pity that Argyle got to my house first. This faithful lover, Wellington, whose love survived six winters, six chilling, killing frosts, sends the ungentle hint to my publisher of hanging me. Beautiful, adored and adorable me, on whom he had so often hung. Is it thus he would immortalize me?
Publish and be damned.
Of course, it could never enter the brain of anyone save of stupidity personified to conceive that so great a man as Wellington ever did anything whatever of which he was the least ashamed or minded my publishing. Nevertheless, since he has threatened to bring forward my soft epistles, in which I remember I wrote that old frights like himself, who could not be contented with amiable wives, but must run about to old procuresses, bribing them to decoy young girls, ought to pay us for the sacrifice they tempt us to make, as well as for our secrecy. However, all I entreat of my late tenderly enamoured wooer is that he fulfil his threat and produce these said letters in court, and lest a small trifle of hanging should be the result, but whether of him or me is yet to be seen, I'll make my will. And so goodbye, old Bombastes Furioso. London, 20th of January. Another lover threatens prosecution. No less a personage than the Honourable Frederick Lamb, who yesterday called on Stockdale to threaten him, or us, with prosecution, death and destruction if his conduct towards me was printed and published in any part of my memoirs. I have certainly told harsh truths of him, I confess. Yet I never deceived him, and I endeavoured to live on nothing as long as I possibly could.
I cannot omit to acknowledge the generous condescension of Earl Spencer, who, though I have not the honour to be in the least acquainted with him, has very repeatedly assisted me, merely as a matter of benevolence. Neither can I express half the gratitude I feel, and shall entertain to the end of my life, for the steady, active friendship Mr. Broom has invariably evinced towards me, actuated, as he is, solely by a spirit of philanthropy.
A pretty list indeed, Stockdale is advertising in the newspapers. Almost every one of my particular friends is among them. The poor Duke of Argyle. What has he done? I am very angry with you. Oh. I don't really think I can shake hands with you.
I have strictly adhered to the truth. You say you have not read even the first part of my book. How do you know that it is severe?
Well, perhaps not. The Duke of Leinster tells me that it is not severe, nor does it, he says, contain any libel.
To be sure not. Why, as his grace goes on, he will find that I give him credit for a little more intellect than a Newfoundland dog. But I certainly wish to explain the Duke of Beaufort's conduct.
Aye, true. The Duke of Beaufort treated you shamefully. You are very welcome to tell the world that I am your counsel in that business, that I said then and repeat now, that he took a shameful advantage of your generosity. There, you behaved only too well.
Thus, then, though many of you are angry with me, you all agree in being disgusted with the heartless selfishness of the Duke of Beaufort?
Tell all the truth of him. But as to the others, pray don't be severe. As for Beaufort, I am of the mind that you should commence proceedings against him for the recovery of the annuity he has seen fit to deprive you of.
I am astonished that you wish me to bring forward a case which I must inevitably lose if the Lord Worcester produces the letter I wrote to him, which was directly in the teeth of the conditions of the bond.
How can you imagine it possible that Lord Worcester, the man who for years has sworn to make you his wife, can appear in evidence against you for the purpose of and robbing you of the trifling independence which you were gracious enough to be satisfied with, and effectually leaving you destitute when you might have been Duchess of Beaufort?
The day of trial arrived, and Worcester had not obeyed his father's peremptory summons to come up to town and attend as evidence against me. The Duke, knowing there could be no other witness, was in a terrible fever of agitation. Just at the last, when the furious Duke had given up all hopes of his son in a great fright, he proposed to my attorney to pay him £1,200 rather than stand the trial alone. Broom had scarcely given his written consent to this compromise, which was immediately signed, when the most liberal, generous, high-minded and noble Marquis of Worcester stepped out of his travelling carriage with my poor, ill-fated letter in his hand. Such, at least, is my attorney's account of the business. I was not present. Thus was I indebted to the Duke's fears of being hissed out of court for the sum of £1,200, which was handed to me as soon as I accompanied the attorney to Westminster Hall. And now goodbye, Beaufort. I have a few more high characters in reserve to sketch for the benefit of my readers, but they are too noble and brilliant to come in at the fag end of a work. I mean, therefore, to conclude these memoirs and take my rest for a month or so in order to collect my ideas for a new work in two volumes, which ought to be printed on the most expensive hot-pressed vellum. In the meantime, proceed to draw these anecdotes into something like the form of a conclusion, because I, their writer, am tired of them, even if you, the reader of them, are not. My sister Fanny never came to the continent, and when I again joined her in London some months afterwards, I found her in very indifferent spirits. She was very ill, and her physician had prescribed bleeding without loss of time. Disorders of the heart are incurable. For another fortnight, Fanny's sufferings were dreadfully severe, and being quite aware of her danger, she requested that her body might be examined after her death for the benefit of others. My readers will, I hope, do me the justice to acquit me of affectation when I say that this subject still affects me so deeply I cannot dwell upon it. From the hour of my sister's death, my dearest mother's health visibly declined, and exactly 3 months after Fanny and breathed her last, I followed my parent to her grave. There was nothing on earth, not even Fanny nor Lord Ponsonby, I ever loved as I loved my mother. I do not dwell on the subject, nor on the manner of her death, because it is to me a very sacred one. I am now about to return to Paris, from where I propose sending Stockdale this volume of my memoirs, provided you are all grateful and civil for the trouble I have already given myself. But I will pause now, at this period of my endeared parent's death, for my habits and character become more serious and melancholy from that hour. One night, I dreamed that I saw my dearest mother standing at the top of a high hill or mountain, so high that her head seemed almost to touch the clouds, and her drapery was of such indefinite texture that I doubted whether I saw a shadow or a real substance. She looked very pale and beautifully placid as she pointed towards the heavens, fixing her eyes on my face. I would have given half my existence when I awoke for such another dream. Having, in that hope, vainly courted sleep for several hours, I will for the present conclude, after wishing to all a good night and pleasant dreams, and slumber's light.
In episode 2 of Publish and Be Damned, the memoirs of Harriet Wilson, written by herself, Nancy Carroll played Harriet. Blake Ritson was Argyle, Barnaby Kay, Wellington, and Charles Edwards, Lord Ponsonby. Fanny was Anna Francolini, Amy, Abigail Burdess, the Doctor and the Duke of Beaufort, Gus Brown, Broom and the Porter, Jonathan Coote, Leinster, Andrew Mudy, and Worcester, Nigel Thomas. Publish and Be Damned was dramatised for radio and directed by Ellen Dryden, and was a First Rights radio production for BBC Radio 4.
On BBC Radio 4.
Exciting in some ways, dull in others, rather risky, perhaps.
New drama based on a real solo flight halfway across the world.
My aim is to get there in good time and in one piece.
Is this really all?
Well, and I suppose to be able to fly.
Writing the Century. Tiger Wings.
Joan Allen.
You on your own?
I'm with my trusty companion, Peg.
Does she need a bed too?
No, the airfield would do her just fine.
Beginning tomorrow morning at 10:45.